Thanks for listening to the Stimulate Run podcast. If you like what you hear, remember to subscribe, leave a rating and a review. If you would like to get in touch or have future guest suggestions, please make contact via email or slide into DMs on any of the social channels. Here's your host, Erwin, with this episode's guest.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the Stimulate Run podcast. When I was looking to approach this episode's guest, I kind of really realized that he is the quintessential reason why I started this podcast in the first place. It's often people we see at events or we hear about or we know of, but we don't actually really know them. And I'm hoping we can uncover, or people who think they know him might uncover a bit more about him. Some people might know him as an ultra runner, but he actually had a professional and elite career beforehand. So without any further delay, welcome to the Stimulate Run podcast, Johan Borta.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And any of the Durbanites who will listen to this, they would refer to you as Botha. But that is incorrect because you're not Durban born and bred. So those people kind of just don't need any of the feedback coming back in. Do you want to give us a bit of an idea of, I suppose, take us back to childhood and then who you are and your upbringing, and we can kind of develop and unpack from there?
Yeah, sure. I was born in Johannesburg, actually. And then when I was 5 years old, we moved down to the coast to Port Elizabeth. That's sort of early days. Then, we lived the rest of sort of my South African life there. And then October 2012, we moved over to Australia. So that was for a playing opportunity with the South Australia Redbacks and Adelaide Strikers. And, initial thoughts were it was going to be a two-year move with maybe an option of a third. And, 12 years later and we're still here. So, and obviously things have gone well. All of us really enjoy Adelaide, and the kids are now at school already. So, it's hard to move them once they're at school. And that's sort of the short story of how things have gone up until now.
So I think you're definitely downplaying the previous career side. So for those that don't know, you played international test cricket. You played ODI level cricket as well. Leadership positions too, which, that just shows that your character more so was highly revered. And correct me if I'm wrong, but also quite young when you were given leadership positions.
Yeah, I was actually quite young. I think early days, like schoolboy cricket, I was always sort of captain or vice captain. So did that right through school till sort of SA under 19, SA schools captain, SA under 19 vice captain, that type of stuff. And then you obviously move into professional cricket. So then you're the youngest again. And I must say probably for about 5-6 years, no leadership role, no official behind your name sort of leadership role. And then it must have been, I think it was 2008, we had an emerging tour to Australia. So pretty decent team. Vernon Philander was in there, Morne Morkel, Justin Ontong. Guys who, became really good international test cricketers. And the selectors somehow decided that I should do it, even though I wasn't captain, I hadn't been captain for like 6 years. And it was a little bit of a surprise. So, did that. We had a really good team. We did well. We won the tournament against an Australia A team, New Zealand A, and an Indian team. And I thought, okay, that's it. That was nice. It was a bit of fun to be in charge and be a leader again. But then that next summer, so summer sort of 2008, 2009, was when the South African test team toured Australia. And for listeners, that's where Graham Smith broke his hand in Sydney. And, I'd already flown over. I wasn't in the test team. I was just coming for the one day. Just thought, okay, I'll just come and do my job. Let me bowl in the middle overs, bat a bit. And then Mickey actually called me in and said, do you want to be captain? Not do you want to be captain, but we want you to be captain for the for this one day, or two T20s and 5 1 days. And I was shocked, surprised, happy, you know, all of it. Because in that team, you had, you know, Herschel Gibbs, Jock Allis, Mark Boucher, Neil McKenzie, you know, real senior guys who are much older than me and played international cricket probably for 10 years already. The two T20s, we played okay. David Warner made his debut in Melbourne, got a big score. Brisbane was much closer. We narrowly lost there. So I don't think many people gave us a chance in that series in the one days. We managed to pull it out, and then we won 4-1. I think it was the first ODI series that South Africa won in Australia. So, you know, it was a pretty big deal. And it was probably one of my highlights actually of my career to sort of lead that team and, you know, come away with a series win against a very good Australian team. You know, they had guys in their prime, Ponting, Hussey, you know, Sean Marsh was there, Brad Haddon, Brett Lee. You know, so it was a very good team. But somehow we just managed to get over the line. I think the first game in Melbourne and game 3 in Sydney, we had to chase record scores, and we did it both times. So, you know, we got stretched, but, you know, the batters stood up. Callis and Gibbs made good runs. De Villiers and Amla made, you know, a couple of big scores as well. It just seemed like everyone at the right time chipped in, and, you know, we got the results.
And you had some obviously big personalities, just based on experience alone. But it was also quite a successful era, that Mickey Arthur era, and the Graham Smith era. What type of, I suppose, any apprehension, or did you just say yes straight away and go, I'm going to almost have my own legacy? Or did you very much go, hey, you guys are here. I don't need to really, I just need to micromanage in the nicest possible way. And keep this train on the tracks?
Oh, 100%. You know, I was never leader, I would say, for long enough to, you know, put my own stamp on the team, select the team, that type of stuff. I was basically just worrying about the on-field stuff. And I was happy with that. I was really happy with that. I didn't, you know, need all the media and selection meetings and all that stuff. I was happy just to, you know, Mickey, to keep running the show. And then, you know, when you stepped over the rope, sort of take charge. I was perfectly fine with that. You know, I didn't need all the extras. And I think for a youngish captain, it was actually a good way of doing it. You know, it wasn't a lot of distractions on the side. It was basically, you're still one of the team, but you just have to make, obviously, a few extra decisions on the field when it came to it. And that was basically as simple as we kept it. I think the first two T20s was a bit chaotic. Like, there was a lot happening. The ball was flying everywhere. And we probably looked a bit disorganized, but I think we sort of ironed that out. And when we got to the one-day series, it was basically, okay, Neil McKenzie is the vice captain, and whatever ideas there on the field, you know, sort of goes through him to me. Well, I think in the T20, it was pretty much like two or three guys running to me and trying to pass some information. We ironed that out a little bit, and it was, you know, a lot calmer come the one days, and it was a good lesson. You know, first couple of T20s as an international captain, geez, the ball was flying everywhere. Warner was hitting the middle of the bat, we got a bit rattled, but, you know, once the one days came around, we had settled down a bit, and, you know, those senior guys actually, you know, helped me a lot in that role then.
And that was pre-T20 explosion, right? And, you know, you've now seen, or you've probably gone along with the explosion, and hence where your cricket career kind of sits at the moment. In the early days, and even internally amongst players, do you think if you went back now and you said, this is what it's going to look like, what percentage of players would have gone, yeah, I can believe you, and others would have gone, you're dreaming?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a tough one. I, you know, as you were setting up that question, I was thinking it used to be, and even that series in 2008, it was sort of the warm-ups to the one days. Mm. You know, I used to play one T20. It was a bit of a, you know, see where the white ball team is at. You fly your new guys in for the tour, the one-day cricket guys, and it was basically like a middle practice against the opposition. That's what it felt like. Like nice crowds. But it was really just to get your one day team together and give them a bit of a run before the actual one day series. And then obviously with the Indian Premier League, gee, things exploded. You know, it just kicked off. And you know, now you have probably, I don't know, 8 to 10 tournaments around the world at different times. Your international teams definitely play more T20 cricket than one day international cricket. And yeah, you know, at times that probably put the one day game under a bit of pressure. You know, if you listen to one day World Cups or one day, you know, series, you think, oh, you know, this is a bit under pressure. The crowd attendance isn't great, but it's still a great format. You know, it's sort of that in between. You know, you've got to have the skill to bat when you've lost a couple of wickets and have the skill to navigate through that. Well, obviously in T20 cricket, you know, the scores just keep increasing. I watched the highlights of a game last night in India. Gee, and they made 275 in 20 overs. And I think that's the highest score I've ever seen in professional men's, like proper cricket. So, yeah, the scores are obviously going through the roof. And it gives belief in other formats. You know, in one-day cricket, if teams make 400, they seem to think, well, that's not impossible. If we bat well, we've got a chance. And these days, if teams have to chase, I don't know, 380 or 420 in the last innings, they seem to think, oh, that's not an issue. If we bat well and we keep our wickets intact for, you know, in going into that last session, there's no problem. We're going to have a full go at it. Where back in the day, if you had to chase more than 250 on the last day, it was pretty much game over. You know, you're not getting there. So it has been great for the game, but, you know, they probably got to be careful of one-day cricket dropping out and T20 cricket completely taking over.
Yeah, and I think, look, were you involved in the infamous run chase where, no, you were, when the Proteas pretty much chased down like the highest one day total? I'm just thinking, like, it's almost like that's where the evolution has come from all the way through.
Sorry, and I'll just try these earphones again.
Sorry. Yeah, you're right.
Can't get it. Crowd in the background. Yeah. Is that working?
Are you there? Yeah, yeah. Cool. Okay. Give me a second.
Sorry, I'm interrupting you now.
Let's see. Yeah, I think I was just talking more of the evolution early on, and you could almost see it from that infamous run chase between, I think, the Proteas, and they just set this unchaseable total when it got run down. But, like you could see that early.
Yeah, that was sort of, I think the breakthrough. So in one day cricket, you know, everyone thought, wow, 434 by Australia. South Africa's got no chance, you know. It's probably one of those, you can say one in 100. You're going to either win it or you're going to lose by a big margin, because everyone, you know, has to come in and keep continuing the momentum. And, you know, that happens once in a very long time where, you know, teams like guys just come in and hit the middle of the bat straight away. Everyone just seemed to, on that ground in Johannesburg, obviously it's at altitude, and everyone just, you know, hit the middle of the bat that day. And I still think, credit to Australia, you know, for assessing conditions, seeing how good the wicket is, and putting South Africa under that type of pressure, because, you know, up until that stage, when the bigger teams played against each other, it's normally like 320, 330 was a big score. You know, and for Ricky Ponting and Gilchrist and them to step out and think, gee, this is a really good wicket, we're going to put them under pressure today, you know, obviously set the game up for what it turned out to be, where they could easily have thought, no, we'll just make the usual 330, 340 and see what happens. On the flip side of that, South Africa just had one way to play. You either lose by 150 runs or you get it. And, you know, luckily for them that day, they got it. And then, you know, that was, it's probably still is the best one-day game, you know, to date.
A couple more cricket ones, because a few listeners will come back and say, oh, and this is not a cricket podcast. But I'm intrigued by, you've now moved to the coaching side and the man management of that and that whole moving nature. you know, one season you've got a guy, the next season he's against you. You could go to a different league and the same guy's against you who was with you 2 weeks before. Like, how adaptable do you have to be? And then also, how do you learn that? Or is that just the way that your nature is?
The last bit is a good question. I think you learn bits of it, but you have to, you know, keep improving on that. You know, players are always talking and, you know, they players are good at sticking together, you know, like for like, and they stick together and they pick out certain things that they, you know, like in a team and that they also dislike. So I think, you know, to have that communication with players is obviously key. You know, you don't want to give them a full rein and just, oh, whatever you guys want to do, we'll do. But I think you do have to listen to, you know, a couple of guys or some of your senior players that you respect in your team. And, you know, if there's something that's not going to plan or, you know, that us as a management can improve on, I think you want to be open to that. You don't just want to be, you know, straight down the line, this is it, and that's the only way things are going to happen. So, yeah, that's something, you know, me growing up and playing and my own career, it was pretty much, you know, work as hard as you can. And that was the only way, you know, like repetition, amount of reps, that makes you better. Well, I think these days you've got to be careful, like we've touched on slightly with the amount of cricket guys play, how often do you train, how do you keep them fresh for games? That's a bit of a balancing act now, because you can't just, you know, train 3-4 days in a row, play. These days you play like 2-3-4 games in 5-6 days in these T20 tournaments. So I think that's one of the biggest balancing acts these days, is to sort of keep your players engaged and fresh. But yeah, it's definitely been a learning curve from, you know, when I started my first time as a head coach at Guyana, I would say to now, it's certainly, I think it comes with experience, like most things. You sort of early days, you worry about everything. You know, am I doing this right? Is that right? Can I do this better? And, you know, there's so much happening in your mind, and you obviously try not to show that to the players. You want to be as calm as you can. But I think these days you pick up on certain little things, and you can sort of draw an experience. Okay, I've seen this before. What do we do now? So I think it's just like anything, I suppose, where once you get a little bit more comfortable and you can read certain situations better, I think you become better at it. Where early days, it was very much, gee, you try and cover every base and you want to do everything and you want to, you know, talk to every player almost after every game. But it doesn't work like that. You know, you've got to trust a little bit yourself, and you've got to trust your staff that, you know, when a guy is the batting coach, you got to trust him with that. If someone's the bowling coach or the fielding or the physio, the trainer, you know, I think those are the keys for me at the moment, is to have sort of good people in those positions. And then, you know, I can go to them and chat to them and get some feedback on certain players, because they obviously also see the players. You know, the physio has players coming through his physio room, you know, for a few hours a day. So someone might say something, and then, you know, he could be the one that sort of just said, yeah, just be careful of this or watch out for that. And, you know, that's probably what I've learned. You can't do it all. And you've got to rely on, you know, the rest of your staff and probably some senior players, because those senior players are almost an extension of your coaching staff.
Yeah, they're probably, the physios will be getting more private intel than you are, to be honest. And the role, it's very much like a subcontract again, you know, going, this is in my best business interest, myself as the business, to now maximize. It might even be down to income, going, I've got to support my family and I need to go get as much as possible for me. But then you've got to bring these dynamics together as a team unit. And I think a lot of people don't notice that also about that elite level sport is, for that, once they cross the line, everyone's together. But within it, it's almost still comes down to being a bit of a business, because everybody's got their own private entity and business arrangements around it too. Gone are the days where, you know, 15, 20 years ago, it was all about playing games, having beers, going off and being 11 best mates, right?
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I think, you know, professional sport, you almost get put into a team. You know, you don't pick playing with your mates. It's not, you know, third or fourth grade where guys have played together for many years, where, you know, you can sort of pick and choose who you play with. Where in international and professional sport, you get put into teams and you just got to make it work. And I think that's where players have got a lot better over the last probably 10 years with all these franchise tournaments. You know, I remember probably the first half of my career, I played for two teams, and that was the team in Port Elizabeth, and I played for South Africa. That's the only two teams I played for. And then the second half, I probably played for another 30 teams, you know, in the second half of my career, because you play one tournament, then the other, and the next year you come back to the same tournament, you play for a different team. So I think that's definitely also helped in my coaching career, you know, different scenarios, different owners, different teammates all the time. Where I think early days, you were sort of a little bit stuck in your ways and, okay, I'm very comfortable in this group and I play my best cricket in this group and I just want to play for this team. But, you know, that doesn't work anymore. You don't just stay with one team. Guys move around so much. And it has definitely become a skill. You know, some definitely do it better than others to get back into or get into a new system. They seem to just draw people to them. And, you know, you certainly want those in your teams, especially the franchise tournaments, you know, to get your team dynamic going as soon as you can. Because the tournament, you know, these days at most you get probably 5 days, maybe less with the whole squad there, full squad. And you've got to, you know, work things out pretty quickly. And you want to, you know, be in a pretty good position come game one, because that's where, you know, you either get momentum or you under pressure straight away. You go, you know, you lose two or three games first up in a tournament. That tournament's basically done. So, you know, a lot of work goes into that first week and then hopefully a good start. Because once you get a bit of momentum, at least, you know, everyone believes in sort of your game plan and what you're talking about. Where if you don't get that win, it sort of gets pushed out, and guys start sort of questioning themselves, am I going to be selected for the next game? And there's nothing worse trying to, you know, keep convincing guys they're close, or when you drop them, they probably know, you know, I've got to give the next guy probably two or three games, and then they start losing a bit of interest. So it's a tough one. That it's hard to, you've got squads of 18 to 20 to 22, that certainly doesn't fit into 11, and it's hard to leave, you know, some very good players out. And that's probably another part of the management that we didn't even touch on, is to try and manage those guys that are sitting next to you on the bench and try and keep them engaged and try and keep them ready for when the opportunity comes. And, you know, hopefully they are ready when it does come.
Yeah, true. I want to kind of interestingly touch on the whole decision to immigrate. My parents did it, so many people do it every day. Yeah. I'm interested, and this might be completely wrong, was it actually possibly better for your family, the fact that you all now came to a new base? Because you would have been used to going in and out. I presume young children were coming along, and this kind of gave you more of a stable base, but your core family were now together. You can be saying that's completely opposite, but yeah.
No, it was definitely that. I remember, you know, firstly, when we came over, Austin was just over 2 years old. And in his first year, I was still playing for South Africa, and I would have missed 6 months of his first year. Where then when we came to Australia, it was definitely that, you know, you're obviously still busy with cricket and you're playing Shield cricket, One Day cricket, and then Big Bash over December, January. But when I left home, it was basically for a Shield game and a One Day game. So you're probably away for 6 days to 7 days, and then you're home for 2 weeks. Where I remember, in that first year, I went to India on a South African tour. I was home probably for a week, and then I went to RPL, which is another 8 weeks. And then they changed so much in the, you know, when they're so young. So that was definitely the tough bit, but things did settle down when we came to Australia. You know, Ashley was born here, so she only knows Australia. And, you know, like I said, we got to year three, and then citizenship was a year away. It was so close. And then Austin went to school in that year. And, you know, that sort of started settling things for us, that, you know, this is probably going to be the permanent move. You know, we've obviously still got family in South Africa. You know, we couldn't all come over, but, you know, and that's what the kids have really missed, sort of the grandparents and that. But, you know, for us as the four of us, it's been a great move. You know, Adelaide's easy, similar to Port Elizabeth. You know, the size, it's coastal, things like that. It's easy to get around. It's not as big and busy as some of the other bigger cities, but, you know, we really enjoy it here. Everything's pretty close by, and yeah, it's been a great move for us.
And I suppose in the weirdest way, my parents say to us two boys now that it's probably delayed the inevitable for your kids, you know, and the likelihood is then you would have been left and they would have come anyway, or they would have gone somewhere else anyway. So the fact that you almost all came together creates that new level of, I suppose, generational connection still. Whereas if at your age they left, then, you know, it creates that separation that you're probably having with your parents now. So,
Good point. Well, I don't think I've ever looked at it that way. So yeah, that's a really good point to, you know, us four to come over. And I think they've got great opportunities in Australia. You know, schooling's great. You know, we've got South African friends here, you know, probably 10 to 12 South African families that have got kids similar ages. So, you know, we've got our own little group here, but, you know, and the kids have obviously got Australian friends with all their friends at school, and, you know, they're really enjoying it, and it's going really well for them. I think it was the hardest for Monica and Austin, my wife, and Austin. You know, early days, he was 2 years old. They just had like a good 2 years of a baby group in South Africa, and then all of a sudden, that's gone. You know, and then I leave once every 2 weeks for a week. So I must say it was very lonely for them at the start. And then things really only started settling down probably after 18 months. You know, I think the first year and a half was difficult. Ashley was born probably 5-6 months after we arrived. So all of a sudden there's a number two who's really small. But yeah, you know, once we got over that and, you know, got some local friends and some South African families, you know, I think away we went, and, you know, everyone's definitely settled now.
And I think sport's the amazing vehicle for that assimilation. Like, I know my parents will say it now that the reason why they were so able to assimilate so easily is because of the two boys playing sport, because you're making friends and they make friends through those teams. And in 10 years time, your kids will turn around and say thank you. And I think you only realize that the older you get, and that's what I've learned now. When you have kids, you go, geez, like, I'm due to go back to Cape Town in 2 weeks, and I know that I'm going to have that reality every time I go back. I go, oh geez, the sacrifice was massive, but geez, it was worth it for our sake and the next generation onwards. But
yeah, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, it's definitely that. I think, you know, they don't always realize it, but yeah, living here, it's so easy. Obviously, the safety is a big thing. They don't know anything else. You know, you can't leave the front door open. You can't just leave your stuff lying around, or, you know, you sit in a restaurant and you just leave your phone next to you. You know, not to completely make South Africa the worst place, but, you know, you just got to be a lot more aware. That's probably the key point there. You got to be aware of things around you, and, you know, who's watching you, but, you know, keeping an eye on you. If you, you know, slip up with something or you forget something, then, you know, people take the chances where, you know, we find, yeah, they don't know anything else. And it's just so easy. You know, kids ride to school. It's not like one of us have to take them everywhere. And that's the same thing for my running. You know, I've said a few times to Monica in the last while, and I said to friends, I wouldn't be able to run like I am in South Africa. You know, any time of day, anywhere, trails, road. You know, I've run a little bit in South Africa. I certainly didn't run as much as I do now, and it mostly had to be in a group. You know, group runs, Tuesday, Thursday evenings, group rides. You know, every morning in Port Elizabeth there's a group ride, because that's where Ironman gets held every year. So it's a big Ironman community. But yeah, everything was sort of group ride based, or if it wasn't that, you had to get a couple of people with you and sort of run in a little group, or things like that. So we're very lucky at the moment to, or I'm certainly, the way and when I want to run is whenever I feel like it. I've run, prepare for backyard ultras, I go for a run at midnight, or I go for one at 2 a.m. just to get used to running in the dark, and what it feels like. And that's just what I can do, and that's great.
Yeah, that reality this week as it gets darker, and it was 5 a.m. and I was like, you're actually really lucky. Like the biggest concern you have right now is falling over. And that was you just remind yourself of how lucky you are. All right, Johan, let's pivot to where people really want us to go, and you probably do too. The easiest way to ask this question, I've thought about it a million times, but why backyard ultras? Why just not 10K, 21? Why the backyards?
I think it started with the shorter stuff. You do a 10K and you think, okay, it wasn't too bad, I can manage that. And then you go half marathon, marathon, and I thought, I still want to be competitive. I think that's the one thing I miss from not playing cricket anymore, is that to compete. Yeah, it's nice to stay fit and it's nice to be part of the group and things like that. But ultimately, I want to compete. I want to try and be the best I can be. So yeah, you get to sort of that distance, and I think the timing was just right. The first time I heard about a backyard ultra was probably 3.5 years ago. So my running had probably gone for about 3.5 years. So it was about halfway in my sort of running career journey so far. And I thought, oh, what a great concept. 6.7K on the hour, every hour. And if you don't want to anymore, you can't anymore, you just stop and ring the bell, or you time out, and that was it. And you run with different people, or you can run with different people every lap. You see different people around you. Like, I remember my first run, and it's actually guys that I met there, and I've run with them a lot since. And I can remember, like, I think it was like hour 15 or 16. It was the first time I saw them in that run. I thought, where do these three guys come from? I've not seen them once in this race. Have they? Well, how did they get into the event? And they'd just taken their time, like 52, 53-minute laps. I'd obviously gone out way too quick and burnt myself. And after 20 hours, I was done. And they went on, I think the three of them did about 27 hours. And yeah, that was the first lesson I sort of learned in backyards. It doesn't matter if you finish the lap in 42 minutes or 58 minutes, you're still in the race. And as Kevin Matthews, a WA runner, always says, I'm still in the co-lead. I'm still right there. I'm leader of this pack. And that's such a great way to look at it. You can be struggling, you can be scraping in, but as soon as the next lap starts and you're fronting up, you basically equal lead again, and you're still in the same race. They can't run away from you. And yeah, that's probably the other thing I found with the longer stuff, going into ultras now, trail races. The good runners, you see them at the start and you see them at the finish. The real good runners, you don't see them at all on course. They're just so fast, they run away from you. And I thought, yeah, that's, I don't know if I really like that. And that's where I think the backyard appealed again, because they can do their own thing, for as long as they want. But as long as I'm sort of at the start line, we're still in it. So yeah, that's probably the two or three things that really attracted me to backyard ultras.
And probably the team connectivity of it. You need a team around you to assist. Whereas you can go and run a half marathon without any assistance, and you can do a marathon. Most people will fly somewhere else and do that themselves.
Yeah.
There's probably a percentage of that too that probably you still enjoy having that away from your main team sport.
Yeah, definitely. When my family can crew for me, they definitely do. Monica and the kids, and Austin has done one with me. He did one with me in November in Loxton. He'll do the next one with me May here in Adelaide in the city. So yeah, it is a bit of a family thing, and it's great for them to help me out and crew for me and be there between every lap. And then over at Hurdy's, they couldn't come over, and I had a great team there. Aaron Young, Margie Hadley, Gemma, Gore. So I had the A team there, and they really helped me a lot, you know, to patch me up, to get me back out there when things got a bit hard, you know, to prepare food for someone you don't really know. And even in the sort of pushing me out there, I've run with Aaron a little bit and probably only once with Margie. And yeah, they just, you know, picked up on a couple of things and, you know, sort of said the right things at the right time and got me back out there. So yeah, I've definitely been lucky with, you know, the events I've done. You know, early days when you're sort of inexperienced in this format, the first one I can remember, I just had Austin with me and he was 10 years old. So he mixed me a couple of drinks and that was sort of it. And he went to bed that night and left me some drinks and said, I'll see you in the morning. And, you know, I didn't quite make it to the morning. I made it to 20 hours and called it. But yeah, as it's gone on, you learn from the better runners. You obviously need a good crew. You want to take the thinking out of it as much as you can, especially when you go past 24 hours. You want to almost not think at all. You want someone to give you your food, give you your water bottle or your drink,
yep,
and your headlight if you need it, if it's nighttime, and away you go. You know, get on with the loop or go and do the loop. And if you, you know, I have not done it before, falling asleep between laps, you got to trust that your crew will wake you up. So, you know, all those little things come into play as you go longer and longer in this format. So yeah, I've certainly been lucky for, you know, my family and then the crew in WA to help me out. And, you know, I think in May, obviously in the city in Adelaide, it will be the four of us again. You know, Austin will run up until when he can and then drop out and, you know, hopefully have a rest and then come and help the crew for the rest of the event.
Yeah. But I'll just, before we let this one go, Johan, your countrymen will still say that you're not a real runner until you do Oceans or Comrades though. So any type of ambition, bucket list, or just no interest whatsoever?
No, it's definitely interest. I think Comrades probably more interest for me. You know, our South African physio, Brandon Jackson, he did, I think, 24 in a row. And then he missed one because we were in the West Indies on a tour, cricket tour. But I think since then, he's not quite done every year, but I think he's up to 29 or 30 Comrades marathons. So, yeah, I've spoken to him about Comrades a lot. I've got, obviously, cricket friends that live in Durban and told me all about it. And a couple of them have now done it. And it sounds like such a great event. So I would definitely one day want to tick it off. You know, I think this year is pretty full at the moment, you know, with my running events, but I certainly want to, you know, give that a go, see where I'm at that distance. And yeah, I think it's just a great day out, you know, support along the route. Two Oceans is probably more scenic, but yeah, I think Comrades would be, if I had to choose now between the two, I would go Comrades for my number one.
Well, at least there's hope and ambition there that they'll then classify you as a real runner. But
I'll tick that
in terms, in terms of the fitness differences. So, you know, to be an elite cricketer, you have to set a certain fitness standard. When you now go to backyards and even running in general, do you think that you're physically fitter? Interested also in the mental fitness, because again, it's a parallel universe. You needed to be as fit in both aspects anyway, right?
Yeah. The mental side is huge in backyard ultras. I think that's probably more important. You know, I think of the events that I've stopped in, I think the mind has stopped me more than physical things because, you know, a day or two later, you think, okay, I actually feel pretty good now. I could have gone longer, but I think your mind is the thing that gives up first. And to get back to the first question, I'm way fitter now than when I played cricket. I think with cricket, your skill can cover a lot of your fitness. You don't have to be, you know, at elite level fitness. If you're good sort of switching on and off between balls, I think, you know, you can go on and, you know, if you get good batsmen, that's what they do. You know, they obviously switch on for that split second or 2 or 3 seconds before the ball gets delivered. And then they walk away and switch off. And I think if you can do that very well, that's after battling cricket, where, you know, in backyard ultras especially, you can't hide. You know, you can't have a bad 15 minutes or 30 minutes. Then your race is over. Well, I think in cricket, especially as a bowler, you know, if you have a couple of bad overs, you can always pull it back later. But, you know, in the running scheme of things, yeah, there's not much space to hide. It's basically what you put in is what you get out. And that's certainly something that I've focused on and concentrated in and put my time in, is to try and be as consistent as I can. You know, training most days a week. I would have one day off. You know, mainly Sundays is my day off, but, you know, I would run 6 days a week. It doesn't always have to be huge distances, but it's the consistency of getting out there. And then to prepare for this, it's different times of day. You know, to run in the heat probably every now and then, not just to run when it's comfortable, early mornings or evenings. Certainly before Hurdies, I did that a few times, you know, run in the heat, middle of the day in Adelaide, just to get used to the heat a little bit. And it's a good thing I did, because Hurdies was pretty warm that weekend. And then, you know, again, with experience, tweaking nutrition, tweaking the amount of drinks to take, you know, I've certainly worked with that in the last probably two or three races, where before, you know, that might have stopped me, but I think I'm getting closer to where I want to be with that. And, you know, walking away from Hurdies, you know, two or three days later, I thought, oh, there's certainly more in the tank. You know, if I can somehow switch off and get a couple of power naps in, keep improving on my foot care, you know, I think that's the one thing that probably stopped me in the end at Hurdies was, you know, my feet got really sore on that hard surface. And people did say that going into the event, you got to be prepared, because it does get difficult. Your feet's going to hurt. So yeah, that's always something to look at and to keep tweaking. And, you know, like I said, my crew patched me up a few times, you know, take care of blisters and, you know, things like that. It was important. You know, I think 3 or 4 races ago, backyard ultras ago, I would hardly swap my socks. You just keep going and keep going till something goes completely wrong, and that's the end of your race. Where now you sort of start thinking, okay, the better runners do this, and they have to do this, and they have to tick this box. And I think, you know, that's where I've certainly learned from watching the better guys that I run with. And you learn along the way, and that certainly helped me a lot to get where I am at the moment. And, you know, I still want to get better at it. I want to get longer, and I want to get to hopefully Perth in October and run in that Australian satellite team.
Yeah, I'll definitely get to the satellite soon. I'm interested in the extended knowledge in the nutrition side, because, again, coming from professional setups, you would have had everything mapped out for you, you know, and it would have been there. You get it, eat it, away you go. So most people would think, oh, this guy knows a lot about nutrition already, but I'm sure there's been some heavy prices to pay nutrition-wise on some runs. You want to talk us through, I suppose, some of your learnings in that space? What are some of the lessons you learned early, and then the things that you kind of had to adapt?
Yeah, I think the biggest lesson I learned early doors was I did a 24-hour event in Adelaide, and, you know, in my mind, I thought, okay, I'm burning about 550 calories an hour. Not going overly quick, but that's sort of roughly what I'm burning. I thought, well, I can just eat the same amount. There will be no issue. I can eat what I burn. And, you know, that's how simple the equation is. And I had a bad stomach probably from hour 12. You know, for half the race, I basically had to go to the toilet every single lap. You know, I just couldn't keep, you know, all that food in. So that was a lesson early doors. And then I sort of dialed it down completely. I would have gone, you know, probably right back to like 150, 180 calories per hour. And then started getting used to that. It was probably too little, but I could get through the runs. I could get through the races. You know, I might not have finished super strong, but at least my stomach started to sort of settle down, and there weren't any stomach problems. And then from there on, I just slowly tweaked it up and, you know, probably went to 250 calories, then 300, And I reckon these days, like in backyards, because it's obviously a little bit slower pace, I could, you know, comfortably eat probably close to 400 calories an hour. And that's quite a lot, you know, for marathon runners and, you know, 21 and a half marathons. I don't think you can eat nearly that much running at that pace. So it's obviously different for each sort of discipline. But that's what I found, you know, I had to learn the hard lesson, then dial it right down to, it's almost just two scoops of Tailwind an hour, because that's 200 calories. So right back to that, hardly eating anything. And then you sort of slowly have a gel on a training run. Then maybe those energy chews, then you take a sandwich and you try and, you know, when you hit a hill, walk and eat. And even that's difficult at some stages. You know, you're breathing so hard that the stuff just doesn't go anywhere. You can't swallow it. And then, you know, you keep tweaking, you keep trying different things. And, you know, I think with the backyard, the nice thing is you go past your aid station every 6.7 Ks. So it's not like you have to carry a lot of stuff. You can have nice variety. You can have, you know, cold, hot, different types of drinks. And, you know, now it's basically just to try and train and see what that maximum is. You know, can I get to 400 calories and keep it down comfortably? And if that's the case, you know, that will be great. So, you know, I'll keeping an eye on that. You know, speaking to Aaron last week or a couple of weeks about Herdies, he reckoned I had too little food to start. I didn't eat enough. Then I started getting tired and, you know, wasn't moving as well. And him and Gemma actually increased my calories and said, okay, let's, for the next two laps, let's give him a bit more. And I certainly felt a whole lot better. Once I ate a bit more, my mind became better and clearer again. Well, I thought it's, you know, I'm just tired. It's just 25 to 27 hours in. I'm just feeling really tired and I haven't slept. But as soon as they gave me, you know, a bit more food, Aaron made sure that I took gels like every two or three laps with me on the lap. And I would have one of them. He said, just make sure you have it in this next hour. And my mind just became way clearer. You know, I started, okay, being clear again what I wanted to do while I was there. So that was another great lesson. You know, it's not just the lack of sleep. It's also your energy is probably starting to drop and your mind starts going with it. And it's so easy in the backyard to find a reason to stop. It is just so easy. Yeah. You know, you've got to try and cut that out. And, you know, I think that was probably my biggest takeaway from Herdies was actually how big a difference food can make at the right time. You know, it's not just lack of sleep. The food actually got me sort of up and alive again and feeling good and I was running well. So I'll certainly remember that one going forward.
And do you carb load going in then, or is it very much just a higher calorie diet just to prepare the body that you're going to be taking in more calories?
Yeah, maybe a little bit more calories leading into the event. I'm not, certainly not one of those that measures my food like to the gram. You know, I need, I don't know how many grams of carbs per kilogram. I certainly don't do that. I might, you know, for the two or three days before, I might just have a sandwich or something before bed, you know, with a cup of tea. So I just don't wake up hungry in the morning. You know, I think with all the training, you know, you don't have full license just to eat what you want, but you can eat quite a bit. So I think the week leading in, I might just have half a meal more, if that. You know, it's for me, it's not a lot more. I think it's, for me, more important that morning of the race to have a good breakfast or lunch. Another good tip I got before Herdies with the heat was from Tim Kaprzak, who I've run with quite a lot. He said, overhydrate the morning of. You know, that he did a study at one of the universities in Melbourne, and it was pretty much they would have two salt tablets and a Gatorade per hour for the 4 hours leading into the event. So it was, you almost arrived there, you know, your stores overflowing. And he reckons that got him through his event in Victoria a week before Herdies. And he said that to me in that week going into Herdies, it's going to be hot. Make sure you overhydrate pre-run. And, you know, you don't arrive 4 o'clock on the Friday afternoon and you already level or, you know, below where you should be. You know, you got to be over when you arrive. And hopefully that will, you know, get you through the first 12 to 18 hours in a decent space. If you obviously keep it up, you know, I was having probably a liter an hour and then a drink while I was at my station. So I was having a lot and, you know, I think it was just enough. I could probably have had a little bit more if I really wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a fascinating one. And, you know, people make mistakes who run 10K and the half marathon, and the learning probably isn't as harsh, even though they think it is. And, you know, but someone always said to me early on is that you're not going to die running a half marathon. Even if you bonk or something like that happens, you're just not going to die. But, you know, the implications at backyard level can actually be quite catastrophic, you know, like just even with the vital organs. And so I think focusing on the little things like your hydration are quite important.
Yeah, no, it is definitely a big focus. And like I said earlier, with the crew just being there and thinking for you, I think that's just as big, because I've in the past forgotten my drink for one of the laps. And, you know, to go 50 minutes without a drink at a crucial part of the race can end your race. You know, you think, okay, I'll make it up in the next lap or the next one, but you never make that up. You know, once that hour in decent weather heat is gone and you've missed it, I reckon, you know, not long after that, things start going south and you struggle from there. So it definitely helps, you know, to have a crew and a good crew to do that thinking for you, to make sure you have whatever you need every lap. So yeah, I've learned that lesson too. You know, I've forgotten my drinks and it's definitely hard from there.
Yeah. I'm interested in like now the satellite champs and that goal. Again, goal orientated and wanting more, which is like, I'm one of those people too. You kind of want everything, but it's good to have those goals and ambitions. You look at where you are now, what do you kind of have to put in place? Do you just think, go about it the way you're going, chip away, or do you kind of go, no, these are the things I have to do? And maybe what sacrifices do you possibly have to give up, a tournament? Or is it that extreme? Or do you think just continue on with your current lifestyle and will work out?
Yeah, I think I'm not far off at the moment. I think, you know, I treat it almost as being a professional. You know, I don't get paid for it, so, you know, but I treat it as one of my two jobs at the moment. I certainly try and recover as well as I can, eat as well as I can, hydrate during the day, you know, ice bath when I can, stretch, breathe, all those things. So I try and do that as well as I can. And then, you know, I don't think I need to miss, you know, tournaments or anything like that. My next one would be June, July in America. And, you know, as a coach, I can run every day. You know, I don't have to be ready to play. It's not like I'm in my playing days where today's a game day, I need to be 100% ready. I can run whatever I want to, really. I can go out at 4 a.m. and run for 3 hours and, you know, get to breakfast and the day just continues as normal. So I think I've worked that routine out pretty well, even on tour at home. You know, interesting one now, when I went to Dubai in January and February, we had a game in Abu Dhabi, and that was an hour and a half away from Dubai. So we just stayed in Dubai for the full 4 weeks, drove to Abu Dhabi, played the game, day night game, drove back, and we got back to the hotel probably 12:30. And I went for a run at 1 a.m. 1 to 4 a.m. just to prepare for backyard ultra, just mentally prepare, you know, as little sleep as possible. And that's just what I did. You know, I went for a 3 hour run at 1 a.m. in the morning in Dubai, and I actually found it great. You know, it's quiet, there's hardly anyone around. If you do run past someone, they think, what is this guy doing? Why is he out here? But, you know, on tour, you can definitely make it work. And, you know, at home now, you know, you can fit it in. I think, you know, I can certainly run at different times of the day. If the day's been busy and I didn't get up in the morning, you know, I can go at 8, 9 p.m. The weather's great, and even when the weather's not so good, I see that as a challenge too, because in these events, you just never know what could pop up. It could be rain, could be cold, could be hot. So I do like to try and train in most types of conditions. With the Satellite Champs, I think it's just the Australian team is just such a draw card. I think it's a great team. There's so many great runners. And I think that's my biggest challenge. Aaron has said to me, Phil has said to me, why don't you go the other route and go to South Africa? You're already qualified. You're probably top two in the country there at the moment in backyard ultras. Why don't you try and go win that when you go to Biggs that way? But I'm thinking I want to run with the best and try and push my limits and my PB as high as it can go. If I never run in Biggs, that's probably okay. I've thought about this over the last while. I probably see the Satellite Champs as bigger for me as Biggs, than the individual world champs in America. Yeah, that would be nice, to run in it against 75 of the best backyard ultra runners in the world. But I almost see the Satellite Champs as bigger for me. And, to run with this group, that's certainly helped me a lot. I would say five or six of those guys in that team already has helped me so much, with tips along the way, little bit of motivation and you improving, you're on the right way, curve, or just comments on, Strava or Instagram, where you're at and, great run last week, things like that. I just think, okay, I want to run with these guys. I think it will be a great occasion to run with the 15 best. And Australia obviously had a very good result 2 years ago to finish third in the world. I think those guys are burning. And goals, Marg is obviously in that team, are burning to improve on that, get to second, get to first, America finished first, and then Belgium second. So I know those guys are certainly pushing each other to keep getting better. And, I'm one of them. I want to keep continuing to get better. I think my training is in a good space. My mileage, it's not crazy distances. I'm still comfortable. I've still, touch wood, got no real serious injuries or niggles. So I find that's been pretty good. There's obviously things you can always improve on. I can recover a bit better. I can sleep a bit more and better. But I think I'm in a pretty good space at the moment. And I've recovered well from hurties. So, I think from next week, I'll start building up again for the month of April and then try and go as long as I can at No Time to Die in Adelaide. I think it's May 17 in the city. And hopefully we get a few good runners there and we put some big laps on and try and get further up that list to secure a spot for October. I think that would definitely be the aim. If we all get there and we're feeling good and the weather's, I wouldn't say the weather's good. We just got to make it happen. If there's no niggles or no serious injuries, and hopefully we can get a little group together and we can work together and get a decent total on the board.
A couple more, Johan, but I'm intrigued if I rewound 20 years, would you ever have thought you'd be running for Australia? Like, or even contemplate like having that as a possibility?
Not at all. Not no, no chance. I wouldn't even have put running in there. When I played, I basically just rode my bike, like I touched on earlier in Port Elizabeth, such a big Ironman community. I would ride with the group rides probably 4 or 5 mornings a week before training. And that was what I did. And then when I went on tour and I couldn't take my bike, I would run a little bit. And, it wasn't more than 10Ks, it was probably more like 6 to 10Ks, 3 or 4 times a week. And that's just what I did. And then about 7 years ago, when I was just playing Big Bash, so that's obviously just December, January, I thought, I've got to find something that obviously keeps me fit, first of all, and it's got to be a bit of a challenge. And I found, that's where running sort of kicked in. And I thought, okay, I'm going to sign up for a virtual run around Australia on Runs of the World, the app, and started that. And that's where the consistency I think really started kicking in. You a lot of us do an event, and then before you know it, 2 weeks have gone by, and you know you've done not much since. Where at least with the virtual runs that I do, you know, even after hurdies, a couple of days later, even if I just go for a 2K walk, and then the next day a little bit more, just slowly start moving again, and I think that's really taught me about the consistency. You know, that I know it sounds silly about a virtual app, but you know, you want to get through it as quick as you can. And yeah, that's taught me my consistency. You know, after an event, you got to get out there again. The movement is just as good for you. You know, everyone says, yep, rest and that, but that active recovery certainly helps me, you know, get moving again. And, you know, it's now not even 2 weeks since, and I'll probably run 3 times this week already. So I'm feeling pretty good. My feet have got better. They certainly feeling better now. And, you know, from next week, I'll probably start not crazy distances lifted again, but I'll get back to consistent running probably 5-6 times next week and then build through the whole of April. And then it's almost time to get ready again for the Front Yard Ultra in Adelaide mid-May.
A lot of self-reflection in professional sport. I'm sure you did it early on, keeping journals, post-matches. But now the runner, let's say, what have you learned about yourself that you didn't know prior to running?
That's a tough one. I think like through my professional career, I definitely always a deep thinker about the game. I like planning. I think that's, you know, it might not always have been the case when I played, but it's certainly come to, you know, forefront when I work as a coach, you know, all the planning, you know, pre-tournament, picking your team, first of all, your squad, what do you want that to look like? Then leading into the tournament, like I said, about that prep week, you know, how do you want it to look? What's your game plan? What do you know, how's it going to look for the players? How much are they going to train? When are we going to, you know, give them a little bit and give them an optional session or a day off? So I like the planning of it all. And I think that's certainly helping with backyard ultras because I love sitting here the week before and ticking all the boxes. Okay, I've got all the socks. I've got my shorts. I've got all kinds of running options. You know, I've got thin shirts. I've got thicker shirts. I've got long sleeve shirts. I've got, you know, windproof jackets, I've got Gore-Tex jackets. So I like the planning. And I think I've always been a little bit like that. And then, you know, the same with the nutrition. Have I got all the boxes covered? Shoes, what shoes am I going to go with? If it rains, you know, I need to have a few options in case my shoes get wet, my socks get wet. So I've always liked the planning. But yeah, I think it's just for me, really, I think what it's come down to a lot is just the consistency. You know, when you, I know when you're a professional sportsman, you get paid to do it, but there's days where you can sort of hide a little bit in the background. You know, I'm a bit tired. I don't want to train as hard today, or you might bowl only 2 or 3 overs at nets and sort of just drift into the background and slowly get your pads on because I feel more like batting today. Well, I think in the running scheme of things, you know, there's no real place to hide. You know, if obviously if there's something wrong and you've got a niggle, you back off and you try and manage that. And, you know, for me, it might be 2 or 3 days of just walking, you know, no real running, let something settle down. But yeah, I think overall, when you fit and healthy, it's certainly to be as consistent as possible. You know, if you start taking shortcuts in ultra running, it probably comes back and it shows in results, you know, where I feel at the moment my curve is certainly going the right way, slowly increasing my PBs. You know, a couple of weeks ago at Hurdy's, a 9-yard PB was a nice one. And I think my main goal going into that was to reach 48 hours for the first time, which in a backyard ultra is 200 miles. So that was definitely sort of my main goal for the week. And then you get there and you think, okay, that at large list is close. Let me try and get to that. And can I now add a couple of laps to get up the list? So that's basically how that unfolded. But, you know, all in all, I think it's just the consistency of it all, you know, day in, day out. You know, I touched on it earlier, it's not just the running. It's the recovery, it's the nutrition, the hydration day in, day out. And I try and treat it as my almost professional sport at the moment. Yes, I am a cricket coach, but I want to be as best as I can. And hopefully I'm an example to others, to Austin, you know, who's 13 years old and he's done one back at Ultra, but at least for him also to, you know, be more consistent. Even Monica, my wife, she started a walking challenge the 1st of January, 2023, and she hasn't missed a day. It's now like 450 days of at least a day. So, you know, hopefully my example shows and she's a great example. And, you know, hopefully Austin sees that and he might not want to always do it now, you know, video games and all of that's very inviting, but the two of us at least try and get out four times a week. It's not big distances, but try and teach him, you know, the consistency is the key in this. You can't hide in training and then expect amazing results in, you know, on match day type of thing. Well, I think in cricket and...
And the demonstration to commitment.
Yeah, and I think in cricket, you know, you can probably hide a little bit in the week. And if you have a good game, no one can sort of go back and pick that out. Or if you didn't have a good game, no one will really look at your training. They just think, oh, you had a bad day. Where, you know, consistency in this is key. And if you don't do it, then it certainly will come back and show.
Yeah, I think for me, a lot of times I reflect on the demonstration of commitment. You know, we think just as the dad, you're going out at 5 a.m. because you want to get it done when they're not, doesn't impact them. But them seeing you do that is almost that early level of you need to commit to things to get things. And, and the same with going to work and keeping a consistent job, you're role modeling. So it's you quickly realize that you might be doing running for you, but the message you're sending is actually committing to something and then they come to your race and that's the end outcome.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think with Austin, Loxton was something new. So the race in November, we had about a 12-week training block and he was great through the training block. You know, I don't think we missed one day, you know, 12 weeks, four times a week. Where I found in this one now, we went to Dubai. I arrived probably home 10 days after them. And I said, okay, now we need to start training for May. And I can certainly see in this training block, it's a bit harder for him to get in there, to get out there day after day. He certainly finds it harder. I'm not sure if it's like mentally, okay, I've done this now. So, you know, why do we have to keep doing it type thing? I've got 10 yards, which is 67 Ks. But I think this one is a little bit more challenging for him, the actual training phase. And we'll see in May, you know, does it show up? You might not reach that 10 again. There's no guarantees in backyards. You know, because you've run 10 before, you don't just start at number 10 next time and carry on from there. You've got to do it all again. You've got to be good with your nutrition, hydration from the start. And I'm interested to see, you know, I think he's definitely not trained as hard. He's still got 6 weeks to go. So if we put in a good 6 weeks, I still think he'll be okay. But if he doesn't, I'll be very interested to see how May goes. You know, he might do 6 yards and think, gee, I can't anymore. I'm tired and I don't want to do this anymore. And, you know, then we can go back and say, well, your training is not being nearly as consistent as for the one, you know, last year in November. And I'm sure that will be his lesson. You know, you've got to put it in.
Yeah. Intrigued to see how that works out. Johan, thanks so much. I think if we were in person, we'd have to probably crack out a few coffees and would still be going early morning. To finish the podcast, what I normally ask every guest is if you had a message to your younger self, what would it be?
Gee, sound like a broken record, but I've touched on it a few times. It's consistency is key. I think that's for me. You know, when you're younger, you sort of think, oh, it's pretty easy. I can just rock up and things will happen. You know, I'm talking more in the cricket scheme now. It sort of comes naturally. If you don't want to train as hard this week, I should still be okay by the weekend when the games come around. But I think that's something I've learned, you know, in the ultra distance, sort of ultra running world is, you know, day in, day out counts. You know, if you do the right things day in, day out, you know, your results should get better. Obviously, there's no guarantees. You know, you could roll an ankle, you could pick up a niggle during a run. But if all of those things sort of fall into place and your body is good, you know, hopefully you've done all the prep and you're ready to sort of enjoy the rewards, you know, for all the weeks and weeks of training you've put in. And, you know, that's sort of the nice thing. That's the end result. You know, you've done the work, and this is just the icing on the cake, really. And that's certainly the way I looked at it, you know, a couple of weeks ago at Hurdy's. I had a good training week, even when I was on tour. You know, I was in the UAE for 5 or 6 weeks, trained well there, came back, continued, and then thought, okay, I'm ready. I want to compete. I was just going to wait for the event in May in Adelaide. I thought, no, I actually want to compete, see where I'm at. And, you know, I think it showed that I had a good training block early in the year. And now it's sort of to level out again, recover a bit, and then go again.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, thanks so much again for giving us some insight into who you are, how where you are now came about. And I think...